Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. And we are going to be talking home repair and improvement. And we're going to talk, it makes us sound very timely that we're going to talk about extreme weather damage. But we were planning on talking about that even before the pretty wild weather that the southern third of the state got yesterday. Joining me today are Ken Adams of Adams Design Construction in Madison. Ken, thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's good to be here, Judith.
And also John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates in Fitchburg. Thanks, John.
Glad to be here.
Well, let's start with the extreme weather that we have been experiencing throughout the spring, but certainly last night, tornadoes, really high winds, hail. You know, on top of what damage there might have been to roofs with ice dams during the winter, I'm guessing there are some roofs out there that need some TLC and some repair. How do you know if a roof needs some work, Ken?
The easiest way is if it's leaking. Then you know for sure that it needs some kind of repair work. But and we were just talking about this before we went on the air. John's been doing a lot of research and a lot of inspections for hail damage and siding and roofs. And you send somebody up there that knows what they're looking for, and they look for broken shingles, big scrapes in the shingles, tears in the shingles, dents in the shingles, and it's pretty clear eventually. You see one or two dents, and it's pretty clear on what you run into. You want to add anything to that,
John? Well, I think you're right, Ken. The place where it's easiest, I've had a few of them where the insurance companies have said, no, that roof is okay, and I've gone up and gone, nah, this roof is damaged. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Easiest place to look is at the edge of the tabs.
Right.
When a big hailstone comes down in the middle of a tab, that impact, the foot-pounds of force spreads out over the whole tab, and when it hits right on the edge, what you find is you can see not just the granules gone and the black asphalt, but you'll often see the white fiberglass of the mat. Mm-hmm. So you know that asphalt's been completely blown off there by the hail.
And sometimes it's a little frown, a little like an upside-down half circle in the edge of the site.
That's correct. And, of course, you take a look if they've got metal, the old turtle or pot vents on the roof, if they're all dented up. I had one where the cars in the driveway both needed $5,000 worth of work, but they said the roof is just fine. Wrong.
Well, I've had a very different experience. Most of the insurance companies have been very good about covering the damage from hail, and I think it's been terrific. I think they've been doing a good job of it. So
no, I think
call
you're
your insurance company. That's one way to start, and then call an experienced roofer or an inspector, and they'll take a good look at it.
Actually, going along with that, not roofs but siding, there was an email from Jane in La Crosse. She needs to replace damaged 1967 aluminum siding. It was damaged because of hail. Mm-hmm. And she's wondering how steel, aluminum, and vinyl sidings compare cost-wise. And then she has a question about insulation, too.
Okay. Well, on the cost from low to high, I think we could start with vinyl is the least expensive if you look at it from purely what it costs to buy it, what it costs to put on. There's a larger footprint, though, because there's some it's very hard on the workers that create polyvinyl chloride. It's not that great for the environment. So it's on your house for 35, 40 years, and then it's in a landfill for eternity. I think aluminum and steel are roughly about the same these days. Aluminum's been creeping up in price, and so that's been affecting the cost. So maybe steel's a little bit better price. The one thing about steel that's very nice is you could get it in seamless, so you can get long runs. It holds up a little better in hail situations. It can be painted over time. So can aluminum. Aluminum, of course, is you've been around for a long, long time. Dents very easily. If you hit it with your kid's bicycle, you know, it's done. It's dented.
Wow.
But on the other hand, it holds up pretty well. You know, it's good protected from the weather.
Now, an addition that we put on to our house, we were trying to go with as green options as possible. And I'm blanking on the specific term, but I think it was like concrete.
Yes,
board.
It was probably called like hardy plank or cement board.
Cement board.
And that's what wood fibers and cement mixed together with a few other things and some adhesives, and it holds up very, very well.
It looks great. And so cost-wise, how would you put that into that range?
Well, it's a little more expensive to install. The product itself isn't that expensive, but you need some specialty tools, and the the elements that you run into, the dust is dangerous. So you want to, if you're putting it on, you want to make sure that you're protecting your lungs. And but other than that, it's great. We like to put on siding, and I know I think John can speak to this too. We like to put most siding on if we can with a rain screen system, and that's where we create a dry envelope on the house with a sub. A subsurface of two layers of felt, or it could be one of the Tyvek type products, and then we put a space in front of it, and the siding, it hangs in front and allowing air to move behind the siding, so the siding is sort of a carapace that the house is underneath, and it really gives a longevity, especially to wood siding. If you have wood siding and you want to do that on an addition or something, one of the problems with wood siding is moisture. It pushes the paint off pretty quickly a lot of times. We do two things. We paint all sides, or you seal all sides of the wood before it's installed, and we like to use a rain screen system. It allows moisture to wick away quite nicely.
Great. I want to make sure everyone knows how they can join in and ask their questions or give their comments. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can leave a comment on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. And there was an email from Laura. She's wondering if you have any tips on insulating a basement. She says, we're getting conflicting opinions.
Well, we have lots of advice. Where does Laura live? Did we get that, Judith?
It doesn't look like it. She says, some tell us we need a vapor barrier to avoid mold. Others tell us a vapor barrier will create mold. Some say to glue styrofoam board directly to the cement walls and then build a framed wall 3 inches out. So she doesn't say where she's from, but I think there's some of the things she's wondering is vapor barrier or not.
Okay, well, we're going to give her a solid maybe on this.
That's very helpful, John.
If we don't know the geology and the water levels and the soil types, generally, then what we're going to suggest is to start on the wall with a foil face rigid insulation with the joints taped. That gives you a bit of a vapor barrier. It's not as tight as the Visqueen plastic, but it gives you the insulation and the vapor barrier. And then after that, your furring strips or your stud wall and your gypsum board over that. Remember that if you're finishing the floor, that is the place where you do need at least a 6 mil poly barrier, even if you don't put it on the walls. Concur with that, Ken?
I do. One thing I was going to say is that in a regular frame construction above ground, we put the vapor barrier on the inside of the wall next to the drywall. In a basement, the way John's describing it, this foam becomes the vapor barrier to the outside of the wall. And that's very important because any insulation in the wall, we want to make sure it stays dry. And moisture can come in through the concrete a lot more easily than it can go out through the basement walls.
Exactly right, Ken. And this foam, the nice thing about the foil face foam is there's nothing in there that mold or mildew is going to grow on. So even if we get a little bit of moisture back there, well, eventually it is going to work its way out and dry.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, hopefully that's helpful to Laura. And we have Ron in Duluth on the phone, so let's go there. Hi, Ron.
Hi. Is there anything you can do about decking that hasn't been maintained and that the wood is starting to crack? Anything that will fill up those cracks or keep it from deteriorating further before you stain it?
I imagine it's treated lumber. Is that what you've got? Yeah. If it's cupping, treated lumber is usually a lot of it, especially the older stuff, with southern yellow pine, and it's got an open grain, so it accepts moisture and releases it pretty quickly, and so it's kind of a volatile wood, moves around a lot. And so you could have cupping where the wood just, you know, turns into a little partial U-shaped piece. It could be checked on the end, so you've got cracking on the ends. Some of the things you could do would be to, you could do a light sanding. You could sand it down and you can put a coat of good quality finish on it. John could talk a little bit more about finishes, but if you've got wood that's splitting and you've got splinters coming up, you'll probably want to pull those boards out because some neighborhood kid's going to walk by and cut their foot on it, or your mother-in-law is going to be visiting, and it's going to be even worse. And so if you get those things fixed, that's a pretty important thing. The other thing you could do is, a lot of the older decks were nailed down, and we like to screw them down. That holds them in place a lot better. So you could re-screw the decks, and that might help out a lot too.
And actually, following up on Ron's question, he was saying a deck that hasn't been kept up. Mm-hmm. What is good deck upkeep? How often should you be doing different kinds of treatments on it?
Well, it really depends upon the wood type. The old treated pine is really difficult to maintain.
Mm-hmm.
The other problem is that before January 1 of 2004, it was CCA treated. So you've got arsenic in it. Mm-hmm. So you really don't want to go out and sand or power wash something that's got copper arsenate
that's
in it.
That's another good point, yeah.
Generally, on the older decks, I've been suggesting to people that to use old-fashioned oil deck stain. The oil is not good for the environment. It's not good for the person applying it. But a Cabot's makes a line that's pretty acceptable. It goes into the cracks. If you paint it with a latex paint and try to put a film on it, what happens is the water gets into the seams and it all peels off.
Mm-hmm.
Maintain it as long as you can. If you're in a dry environment, the deck not on the north side of the house, sometimes if they're screwed down, you can unscrew the boards and flip them over. You know, and that way they're going to be crowned rather than bowed. So that's one way of looking at it. Really long term, you're looking at replacement with some of the newer products that are out there. And there are certainly a very large number of them of new plastic composites that will last a long time.
Ken, did you want to add anything to that? Or
no, I think John said
okay,
it all.
Well, good job, John.
Yes.
All right. And let's go to Madeline in Oconomowoc next. Hi, Madeline.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Yes, my question is it worthwhile to get, I think it's a styrofoam-backed siding? Like, if you do have a vinyl siding, is it worthwhile to get the insulated siding?
The styrofoam-backed siding, my experience with that is that it's not insulated enough to really do any good. Typically, and I imagine you're talking about the inserts that you drop behind either vinyl siding or aluminum. Is that what you're talking about?
I don't know. I mean, years ago we actually had it installed.
Yeah.
Was it already adhered to the backing or not?
Yeah, the problem is, first of all, there's not enough insulation to really do much good. And secondly, there's a break in the insulation at every joint. And so you're really just wasting money. The only thing that it really does help do is help deaden some of the sound. So it's a little bit quieter inside the house. But I think you would be better served if you were to insulate the sidewall and do a very good job underneath the siding, and then hang siding separately. Treat it that way.
So it sounds, Ken, like you're saying, I mean, it's in the same space, but associating it more with the wall instead of with the siding.
Well, yeah, basically, what you want is you want an insulation area that's completely, what's the word I'm looking for?
You want a continuous.
Yeah, continuous, thanks.
Right, with an air barrier.
Thanks, I need a noun advisor here, John. I appreciate that. So if you have a continuous insulation with a vapor barrier, and then put your siding over the top of that to the outside of that, and if you use a rain screen system, that's even better.
Great. We are talking about home improvement and repair with Ken Adams of Adams Design Construction and John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. If you would like to join in, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. Jennifer Dargan is our on-air producer today. She will be happy to answer your call. And you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Stay tuned. We're talking home improvement and repair with Ken Adams and John Freiberger today. And Ken and John, there was an email from John in Solon Springs. The siding color is powdered. How can I prepare this surface for painting?
Well, it sounds like the must be a metal siding, and it sounds like it's got some oxidation on it. And the paint companies generally offer paints, especially formulated, for metal siding, and I would select a paint and then take a look at the cleaning instructions that manufacturer has.
Great. All right. Hope that's helpful, John. And Ellen in Waupun has a question for you, so let's go to Ellen. Hi, Ellen.
Hello. I appreciate you taking my call. We have a concrete porch on the north side of our house that formerly was carpeted. We didn't like the carpeting. We took it off. There was, of course, glue residue, which we tried to work off, but still had to do something. So my husband painted it, and it looks nice, but it's very slippery when wet. Do you have any suggestions for us?
Is it holding up well? How long has it been?
He seems to like to redo it every year, but it's not a big job. He uses a roller and he prepares the surface, but it holds up pretty well. There's a few spots every year that chip away.
Well, the least expensive way to do it is you could add some non-skid. They make non-skid, and you can get it in paint stores, some hardware stores, boating supply stores, and put it into the paint the next time you paint. And that might help. I think there are some paints out there now that come readily non-skid or are promoted as being non-skid. That might be helpful, too. Beyond that, stripping the paint and grinding off the glue, if you have to check it to make sure it doesn't have any hazardous materials in it, and redoing the entire floor probably isn't, doesn't sound like it's in the cards for you.
Is the paint that is non-skid, is that like a sandy element in it?
It will have a little bit of a texture, but it won't be sand finish like your walls. It'll be a much finer sand.
So it's more of a grit.
Yeah, it's more of a grit. Not like dirt, though.
No.
It's like if you were walking on a boat, if you were ever on some friend's pontoon boat or something, and you walk out on it and you feel the little bit of texture on the deck helps you keep your footing, and that's what this is.
I learned the hard way, actually, painting a wooden porch. Mm-hmm. That the non-skid stuff might help, when I almost lost a friend who was on crutches So the next time I repainted it, I added some of that, and really you can't tell to the eye at all that there's anything in there, but it's definitely much less hazardous.
Yeah, and it's not uncomfortable to walk on barefoot.
No, not at all. It's not like sandpaper or anything like that.
Good luck to you.
Great. Bye-bye. Thanks, Ellen. And we have Harold in Superior next. Hi, Harold.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to thank you guys for taking the time to do this program. It's always very interesting and informative. I wished I could remember it all.
You can always re-listen in the archives if you want to refresh your memory.
Well, yeah, I've got a lot of handyman books like that. I open them up 3 months later and I go, gee, I don't remember even reading this. I got to remember this now, so I put little place markers on them. You know, one question I have, people are putting styrofoam on the outside of their house, and in my way of thinking, that is kind of a negative vapor barrier. In other words, moisture goes through it, hits the styrofoam, and I'm sure some of it will pass through, but I don't look at it as being permeable, and I remodeling my old house here, 100-year-old house, I knocked off a lot of the plaster on the outside walls, and then I put styrofoam on the inside and sheetrock over it, and oh my gosh, it's so toasty. You get a good seal right up against the ceilings, and well, the option even is to do a ceiling on the upper level, you know, What are your thoughts on that? And I have one other for you if you have the time.
Okay. Well, let's have John respond to that question.
Yeah,
first.
Harold, what we specify when we're looking at insulation systems is, it sounds like pretty much what you did is we fill the cavity, but then we'll put at least an inch of foam over the studs themselves, either on the interior or the exterior. In fact, we've been doing it more on the interior in the last few years. What that does is that stops the bridging that the framing will cause, because you get this nice insulation between the studs, but then the studs are carrying heat to the outside. So covering the studs one side or the other with styrofoam really is a great idea. And you've got a 100-year-old house, and you've put a vapor barrier on, and that is something that is heavily recommended. In fact, if it's historic and covered by Department of Interior standards, it's absolutely required. So it sounds like you've got a real good system going there.
Yeah, the other thing is that when you have that chimney effect, when the heat goes through, any heat that's lost through the walls, even with insulation in the walls, you have some heat that will naturally go up right up to the upper plate where you're stopping it out before it gets anywhere. And, you know, put plywood or something that's real strong on the exterior in case you get hit by one of those tornadoes. Maybe it would make a difference. The other thing, and this is kind of whimsical, but, you know, I was looking at methods to attach decking, and I had bought fairly inexpensively some galvanized stripping that you could screw in, but that's no longer carried, at least locally, that I've been able to find, and those little ones are so darn expensive. So I took some washers, and I screwed in at a 45 degree, and when you screw that in, the washer bends both ways and holds the board right down just as well as those $1.50 a piece jobbies.
That's if you're blind screwing it. If you want to get the screw,
From the underside.
The only downside of that is you have to have the boards a little farther apart so that you can get your screw gun in there, the screw tip in there, right?
No,
not a big deal.
No, not at all. In any case, no matter what you're using, you're usually putting a screw in at about a 45.
Yeah.
And so this I don't know, it seems to...
So it sounds like you do read a lot of handyman books.
Well, that one I came up with on my own.
Oh, well, maybe you should consider writing a handyman book.
Well, I don't know about that.
Well, we'll try to remember that advice of yours like you try to remember what Ken and John say.
Hey, thanks.
All right.
Thanks
well,
for your call.
Give it a whack.
Thanks a lot, Harold, for that call. Let's go right to Ronnie in Germantown next. Hi, Ronnie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question with regards to replacement windows. I have a couple of windows that the wooden windows, and they've rotted. And I want to find out if it's better to go back and just get those inserts in wood and then have them painted to match or to go with the newer fiberglass windows.
Ronnie, how old is your house?
The house is 20 years old, but the windows are 10 years old.
And they've decayed in 10 years?
Yeah, they really rotted out. And only so far I've been able to find one window, you know, the two sides. They are those crank-out windows.
Mm-hmm.
So those two and the garage window are the ones that have rotted out. And when I talk to people, they say fiberglass, then it's not going to match the rest of the house. And if you do wood, then you got to... I found a place where I can get them the same size, but then you got to paint that and, you know, match the paint and so on.
Yes, but at least it matches the rest of your house. Well, first, Ronnie, a window should not decay in 10 years unless it was really, really a bad window. And what you may want to call the manufacturer of the window. We had some problems with a brand that I won't mention after 10 years of age, and the manufacturer said, we will replace all the windows. In fact, we will replace all the windows in the house that haven't shown decay yet. So the first thing is check with that manufacturer. If it's a good and reputable manufacturer, they may take care of you. Secondly, I don't know how well built your house was. It's 20-some years old. The question on inserts is, was the interface between the window and the wall well sealed? Mm-hmm. Because you may put a brand new sash in there but have a lot of air infiltration outside on the jams. So that's something you should probably have your carpenter take a look at. If he takes off a piece of outside casing and there's open joints going all the way around that window, maybe he can seal them without taking out the jam, or maybe there's decay in there as well. So do a little bit of investigation with a local carpenter. Check with the manufacturer before you make any decisions.
There's also flashing issues that you could run into, as John was saying, about the way the window is attached to the wall. There's specific flashing that's supposed to be installed, and I've seen on quite a few homes built in over the years, that's the first thing that carpenters will skip and skimp out on, especially inexperienced people will put a window in or put a door in and not put the flashings in or not put them in properly. So look at those things. Have your carpenter look at that, too.
That's a very good point. We find about 50% of the flashings are put over the top of the water barrier instead of in back of it. So what the flashing does is it collects water and dumps it on top of the window and causes the window to decay.
Yeah. Does a nice job of funneling it right in there, right?
That's right. Speeds it up. Speeds up the process.
Thanks for that call, Ronnie. And actually, let's talk about windows a little bit. You know, they can be a big expense, but they can also really improve energy efficiency, especially if you're replacing old windows that are well past their prime. But how do you know when it makes economic sense to replace your windows, and what's the general payback time?
That really depends. And if we go back to what we just said to Ronnie, air infiltration is really a very, very big issue. If you replace a window with a new window, and the new window leaks very little, but you don't do a good job of sealing in the window, and we see this a lot with replacement sashes, you may have very little energy payback. The other thing you have to take a look at is the quality of the windows. We see a lot of very inexpensive, I won't use the word cheap, but I should, windows that are being sold by people. If you have an old farmhouse like mine and you've got an old double-hung sash with a storm window, you've actually got about an R2 rating on that assembly. If I replace that with a brand new casement window with a half-inch airspace, I'm going to have an R2 rating.
What is the R2 rating?
That's our resistance to thermal flow. So I could spend $30,000 on my house and have absolutely no energy savings unless at the same time I got rid of the air infiltration. So the same with Ronnie. I think you need to have somebody take a look at the installation of the current windows. In many cases, people call us and say, we're thinking of replacing all the windows. We look at them. They're beautiful old-growth pine windows that have never been weather-stripped. So you can weather-strip the whole house for $500. And if you can't take the exterior casing off and seal around the edges, at least you can caulk around them. So very often, you can spend $500 and get a 2-year payback, or you can spend $30,000 and get a 90-year payback. And so you really need to think about it. Some of the sales pitches I think that we get on window replacement are a little bit unethical. Do you agree with that, Ken?
Well, I know that there are some good inexpensive windows, but you have to be very careful what you look for. And it's usually, if an installation and window package is very cheap, it's cheap for a reason. So, yeah, I agree with you, John, on just about everything. One thing I'd like to add, though, is your comfort level is very important. So if you've got this beautiful old house and these windows can't be sealed, but the trim is beautiful and the exterior is in great shape, and all you need to do is get a better window. There are inserts that can be installed. You want to make sure that you seal around them, seal in the cavity where the sash weights would go if you have an old sash weighted window spaces. And there's some very intelligent ways to do that and do that very effectively. So that's another option that you have at your disposal. That could also add comfort. I know my house was built in the 1920s. We couldn't sit by the outside wall in the wintertime. We just couldn't sit there. It was just too cold because mm-hmm. in those days they also designed the heating system improperly. So we put new windows in, and lo and behold, now I can sit in a T-shirt and watch the boob tube. So
well, there you go. Life is good.
Life is good.
All right. Let's go to Peter in Wausau next. Hi, Peter.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. We are getting our old deck resurfaced with 1x6 cedar, and we're also building a gazebo on the deck for a screened-in gazebo. And we had terrible luck with the water-based stains that every year, and just sheets of it would peel off. And I'm wondering, we're starting fresh with fresh new wood. I'm wondering what the best treatment is. How often and what type of treatment to give it to keep it looking nice and wood-like?
Well, that's really common for cedar to push finishes off the wood. I see that time and time again. Beautiful cedar wood, it's got a finish on it, and a year or 2 years later it starts to flake off, starts to push off. On all the horizontal surfaces, on the vertical surfaces like your balusters and the undersides of the railing, the newel posts, that probably still looks good, but the rest of it, all the flat stuff starts to go. And I don't have an easy solution for it other than continual work so that you put it in a schedule so that you're going to clean and reapply your finish of choice every year or 2 years. I know some people use the, CEDOL finish. That stuff is notorious for having to be redone over and over and over again. Otherwise, it looks terrible. Oils are I think, very good. You could use linseed oil mixed with a little thinner. You could use a teak oil, but you have to go on. You have to do it regularly. Go ahead, John.
No, John
knows a lot more about finishes than I do.
Well, yeah, and there's cedar and there's cedar also. There's dense inland red cedar that has a pretty closed, tight grain that is properly sawed is going to move a lot less than you'll buy incense cedar for decking. Well, it's really. It's really a very, very soft form of cedar. Mm-hmm. The other thing to maybe check at is perhaps a polymerized tung oil might work for you as well. I use that a lot. There's a company called Sutherland and Wells in New Hampshire or Vermont, I believe. And she is a marvelous chemist. And we have been using a lot of her tung oils for both interior and exterior work.
But, that's right. You got me using that. And I've had some pretty good success with that, John.
So. But you're certainly right, Ken. Oil is the water-based things. And we're going to run out of oil at some point. I mean, the EPA is going to tell us we can simply no longer use them. But the tung oils and things maybe will be around for a long time. So you may want to think if you're going, this deck's going to be there for 20 years, you don't want to use Smith's oil stain because Smith's oil stain may not be made 5 years from now.
Right.
So maybe the polymerized tung oil is a good thing to look at.
I've had some good luck with a product that's called Velvet Oil. Now, so that's made for rubbing hand finishes on inside wood. And you put 20 or 30 hand rub finish coats on a piece of furniture, and it looks like the grain is a foot thick. And I put some on a picnic table a few years ago, and I applied it every year. And it's holding up pretty well. And so and the nice thing about it is once it's cured, it's food grade. So it's very low VOC. It's food grade.
VOC is?
What are they
called? Volatile organic compounds.
There's my noun advisor. Yeah. Thank you.
And so it's not off-gassing a lot.
That's right. Yeah. It's a fairly environmentally friendly as far as oil finishes go. And Once it's cured, you can eat off it. Not that you'd want to eat off your deck, but you'd know that it's a. You got children crawling.
Well, the 5 second rule if you drop your burger. I don't know.
Or if you have children or pets, that's a very important too. So yeah, you might try something like that too. And the nice thing about that is that's sort of a finish. Velvet oil is that it if it doesn't work for you, you can go over the top of it.
Great. Thanks for that call, Peter. And actually, we had an email that goes along with that. Kathy emailed, I've seen rubber brick pavers in various building centers suggested for placement over wood decks, concrete, etc. We purchased rubber brick pavers to see how they worked on our 15-year-old deck of treated wood. They actually look nice, but I'm concerned about water being trapped under the 18-inch square pavers. What are your thoughts of that as an option for deck repair?
I think that the recycled rubber pavers are good. The one that Ken and I tend to use comes from a company called PlayGuard. And if you just Google PlayGuard as one word, it'll come up. What I like about that one, Judith, is that if you look at the bottom, it looks like an array of Dixie cups.
Yeah.
So in other words, air can get through and water can get through, and you set them down in 2-foot squares and they snap together. So if you want to get under and power wash the deck to get the grime off of it once a year, you just unsnap them, put them in the yard, power wash, put them back down again. In fact, we're now recommending that our architects and our carpenters design their decks in 2-foot increments so that the play guard will snap into place without extra trim pieces.
That's how I design. That's a good point, Jen.
Great. Thanks for that. And one of the things that we wanted to talk about, too, is extreme heat. And, it seems like we go from 50 degrees to 90 degrees back to 60 degrees. I mean, we're nothing if not extreme in Wisconsin. And it seems like, it's kind of a constant wanting to be able to get hot air out of the house as quickly and efficiently as possible. What do you do to vent an attic, and is that a good solution?
Well, first of all, let me say that the way my wife gets hot air out of the house is she sends me to the store. But
saw that one coming a mile away
sorry,
again.
Yeah, most people are too young to know my jokes. But there's a couple of different ways to vent an attic, and one of the first things I want to say is that you need to be consistent. If you have fairly complicated roof, you want to have the same type of ventilation in all of the areas, because if you mix them up, they can fight against each other, and you can draw air from one high vent to another and not get air circulating, for example. Having said that, the standard is that you want to have 1 square foot of ventilation for every 300 square feet of flat surface, and half of that should be on the low end. That's the way the code reads. It reads a little more eloquently and dryly than that, but that's how it reads. And so soffit vents would make up 50% of that ventilation, and then a ridge vent of some sort or another. And we prefer continuous ridge vents when we can, because then we have a nice even flow. We have continuous soffit vents and continuous ridge vents, so the air is circulating very evenly through the house. There's other things that can be done, and I don't know if we should go into more detail.
Sure.
On them
why don't
now,
we talk about that a little bit?
Well, I'm going to throw in my usual recommendation that people go to coravent.com, C-O-R-A-Vent.com. And what's great about this website is Ken and I order a lot of stuff from them for historic houses. So if you've got one of these Cape Cods with this tiny little overhang,
fascia with no soffit.
That's right. They make things that you can use, but they give you worksheets. They give you cross-sectional drawings. You can actually read this thing and measure your house and figure out how much venting you need, and they'll show how to maybe get shoots in on a Cape Cod. So a real nice education from that one website. And there are so many peculiarities in venting, but I think I just want to emphasize Ken's statement on consistency and the need for soffit vents. If you only put upper venting in a house, you are going to have significant problems. In fact, the code actually allows you to have all soffit venting and no upper venting, but it forbids you from having all upper venting because you'll start sucking air right out of your house. Mm-hmm. So the air infiltration issue has to be considered with the venting.
And so the soffit is the lower part.
That's the part where the gutters attach
right.
to the
so,
underneath.
So
part, yeah.
kind of where the roof and the walls meet.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay.
And this, of course, Judith, is not just, we're talking about this today because it's hot, but if we were here at our December program, we'd be talking about this because of the ice damming. So mm-hmm. we're trying to get the heat out of the attic, both in the winter and in the summer. So in the summer, we're comfortable. And in the winter, we don't have the ice damming. The other thing that we need to also consider, because we were talking about shingle failure earlier, is overheated roofs will cause premature shingle failure.
Mm-hmm.
And we have had some companies actually say they would not honor their warranty now on a non-vented roof if they determined that the failure of the shingle was due to heat. So very important consideration.
And I just want to let our listeners know that Jennifer Dargan, our on-air producer today, put up the CoreVent link on the Facebook page so people can just go there and click through and get those resources. And we are talking home repair and improvement with Ken Adams and John Freiberger today. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email talk@wpr.org. Or you can leave a comment or a question on our Facebook page, which is The Larry Mueller Show. We'll be back with more in just a moment. Home improvement and repair is our topic today, talking with Ken Adams and John Freiberger. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. So glad you could join us on the Ideas Network. And let's talk for just a little bit more about the keeping hot air out or in, depending on what the season is. One of the questions I had, and it kind of ties into the window questions earlier, is skylights. How energy efficient can skylights be? Do you guys recommend them, or do you suggest that people try to use other techniques for getting more natural light into a room?
I think skylights are a very good solution. They are quite standardized. Companies like Velux have been making the product for many, many years. They come with their own flashing kits. They're fairly foolproof to put in for a fairly handy carpenter. Mm-hmm. The glass in them, you can get up to R4 glass. One of the big problems that I'm sure Ken has seen also on skylights is you go up in the attic and you see this shaft, this wooden frame shaft going up to the skylight through the attic. and somebody had stuck some insulation between the studs and it's all fallen out. So if you do put in the skylight, the big heat loss is really not through the skylight and assembly in the glass, because that's really well controlled by the manufacturer. But it can be that shaft, and we're really telling people that they need to use a urethane foam insulation to keep that nice and tight.
Yep, great point. The other thing I wanted to say is that Velux, I think also Anderson skylights meet Energy Star ratings. So they are very good windows, and I've put in probably at least a couple of thousand of them, and I've only had two fail, and the manufacturer stood behind them. So that's pretty good.
Great. All right, let's go back to the phones because we've got some people waiting to join in. We have Jim in Darlington next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I have a question. We're taking off the old wood siding, and we're going to put on vinyl. And my question is, what are the materials that should be placed under the vinyl siding to really be sure it's a good job done?
The vinyl siding is not terribly dependent upon, for its structural integrity, upon what it's put over, as long as there's decent nailing. The question that we have with vinyl siding that people need to remember is it is a rain screen. It is not a water barrier. So you have to really be sure, Jim, that you have that house tight before the vinyl goes in. You'll notice that on the underside of the vinyl siding, you're going to have little weep holes about every 3 feet. That's to let the water out. And if that water gets in back and gets into, say, like a, if you're just putting it over an oriented strand board, let's say, or something, without a water-resistant barrier, you're going to end up having problems. So the first consideration, we keep talking about air tightness and infiltration. Try to get an air barrier on the house, seal it around all the windows and door penetrations. Secondly, you can add insulation on the outside. We talked earlier, I think with Harold, about getting rid of bridging by adding some additional styrofoam on the outside. If you tape the joints on the styrofoam, that will act as a water barrier. But what we really suggest is putting something like a Tyvek or another form of commercial water barrier on the house, sealing that tight, then putting on the foam, sealing that tight as a second barrier, and then have your installer put up his vinyl siding. That gives you the air infiltration system, the thermal system, the rain barrier system, and a nice siding job.
Perfect. Judith looked at me and said, you want to add anything? And I'm saying, no. I mean,
what can you add to that?
It's one of those things that putting the siding on is the least expensive part of the process. It's getting all of the substrate done correctly. If you do that right, any siding that you put on is going to last a long, long time.
That's correct, Ken. And you're also going to get a payback. I mean, you know, Jim, you're probably replacing the wood siding because you're sick of painting and it's peeling paint. And so if the only thing you do is get rid of the painting duty every other year, you're not getting real good payback. But if you can cut that heating bill on your house by 20% and lower your air conditioning as well and make it more comfortable, well, then you're really getting a payback for putting your vinyl siding on, other than not having to go out and scrape and paint all the time.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks for that call, Jim. And let's go to Robin in Appleton next. Hi, Robin.
Hi. My husband and I are helping my daughter and son-in-law with a project. However, they happen to live in San Francisco, so it's a long-term thing we're working on here. But we've had a discussion about how to do this. It's a porch, homeowner-built porch, on a house that's from 1911, and it's on stilts. Now, San Francisco doesn't freeze, but it does get cold and damp, and that porch gets pretty chilly, on those days. And they want to finish it off and are concerned about flooring / insulation, maybe under the flooring or under the porch or whatever. Do you have any suggestions?
Yes, I do, Robin. And my son lives in San Francisco, and boy, when the fog rolls in, it certainly does get cold and damp. Ken and I tend to use a lot of urethane two-part foam insulation. The nice thing about it is it gives you not just the thermal barrier, but it gives you a moisture barrier as well. So you won't have that humidity from the fog creeping up through the floor system. I would put a additional vapor barrier or water barrier on the bottom as well, to try to doubly seal it. San Francisco is a really tough climate to design well in. One other thing I want you to make sure that your son or daughter looks at is, before you do anything, check the structural integrity of this porch, because you said it's up on stilts. And lateral rigidity in porch design has been a weak point. Until those many people were killed in Chicago a few years ago, it really didn't come to our attention. And Ken and I see so many porches that are poorly constructed. So get a home inspector in California to go out and take a look at it and make sure that it has good integrity before you start closing it up.
Great. Thanks for that call, Robin. And let's go to Ron in Edgerton next. Hi, Ron.
Hello there. I'm just giving people an idea. I don't know if I did the right thing, but I bought, a couple years ago, Lamonstone Cape Cod, hand-built in the 1920s. It's a beautiful old house. But in that era, they didn't put eaves on of any kind. And literally, it would rain like we just had. I'd have so much water in the basement. I tried everything and didn't work. Well, Edgerton is also known for clay. So when they built the addition, they took all the clay out, dumped it all over the yard. I couldn't go grass, couldn't do anything. And last year, it was part of the garden tour. So what I did is I dug a hole in the clay, a big hole, put good dirt in, planted something, and all that clay I packed completely around the outside of the house, like toward the house at the foot and a half. I covered the stone and gradually sloped it out 4 feet because that clay gets so hard you can't even put a shovel in it. And last night when it rained, I did not have a drop of water in the basement anymore. It does not seep through that clay. It just runs off.
Well, let's see what John and Ken have to say about that. John?
Ken's pointing to me. It sounds like, Ron, you've got a bentonite yard there. And, of course, we use clay for waterproofing. In fact, if you build a toxic waste pit, what you line it with is clay. So you're right, Ron. It will not let water through. And that's great for keeping water out of your basement, but that's bad for keeping water in your Lamonstone, which you've covered with clay. Since your house was built in the 1920s, I know that Lamonstone was not supplied with a weep system. There's no airspace in back of it, and what you have is you have the stone, you have a layer of felt, and then you've got the wood of your house. Now, what happens is that was laid up with a lime-based mortar with a little bit of Portland. The moisture goes through the stone and through the mortar, goes down along that felt, and runs down where the ring joist is. And now you've covered that with clay. You may end up developing decay down there. So I think you're going to have to take a look at another solution.
And what kind of other solution might there be? Ken and John are both pointing
and
looking
at each other. We're sort of pointing at each other. First of all, the idea of having the grade run away from the house is a good idea. The materials is the what we're questioning right now. Also, the material up against the house is the issue. Do you have gutters on your house?
No.
Would your house benefit? Would it detract dramatically from the quality of the look with gutters?
Well, the problem is it's a Cape Cod.
Yes.
The front has gutters because that has an eaves, but the side was built so it's straight down. There's no place to put a gutter.
Straight down.
Direct
fascia.
So that's on the gable ends or the...
Right.
Okay. And that's where you're having some issues there, too. I don't have an easy solution for the gable end. Grade is the big one.
You're right there, Ken. You really have to somehow come up with grade, and sometimes you end up with an incredibly flat lot, and it makes it really, really difficult. If the clay, depending upon how thick the clay is, my farm, I've got a foot of black dirt, 3 foot of clay, and then 200 and some feet of sand. We just put in a deep rain garden. We had to dig through the clay to get down to the sand. But that rain garden will take a great deal of moisture. And, Ron, what you may want to do is just go online and take a look at rain gardens and see if that might help. Maybe you can add some beauty, and the garden tour will have something else to look at the next time they come. And that'll give that water some place to go.
Great. Thanks for that call. Now, I have a question that I'm guessing neither of you have ever been asked before. We have an email from Corey in Green Bay. Are there any issues with considering putting a slide in a house that goes from one floor down to another one? Is there code about that or an insurance risk?
I don't know. I think it's a great idea.
I was going to say, I think Corey needs to invite us over.
My granddaughter suggested that to me when she was four. So, I say go for it, just remember that you better Make sure you're well insured.
We actually did put a fire pole in the house.
Uh-huh. That was going to be my follow-up.
Yes, we did put a fire pole in the house, and you can look in the code in chapter, I believe it's in chapter 21, and it's going to tell you that you've got to have a gate around your fire pole, and you have to have a guardrail that is 36 inches, so when you want to go down the fire pole, you have to open the gate. Now, I don't know exactly.
It's probably the same thing for a stair, or for a slide, I'll bet.
The question is, who closes the gate?
Automatic closer.
There you go. Well, I thought that might stump you, but not completely.
I think it's a great idea.
Great. We have just about a minute before we go into the news, but have you put some other pretty unusual features in homes before?
Well, let's see. I had a guy that worked for me put a basketball court in a basement. That was pretty good. 16-foot ceilings.
Wow. In a basement. Wow.
In a basement, yeah. We built 6 bunk beds out of logs in a basement at a getaway cabin. The basement was a walkout basement, slept 16. I've done a lot of unusual things over the years. So,
well,
how about you, Jen?
I'm pretty mundane, generally. I guess the fireman's pole is probably the one claim I have for fame, and that was 20 years ago.
Great. We are talking home improvement today with Ken Adams and John Freiberger. Stay tuned. We're talking home improvement and repair today with Ken Adams of Adams Design Construction and John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller. We're glad to have you along today. And one of the topics we wanted to talk about is repurposing space. So, for instance, if someone is looking to turn a porch into a screened-in porch or maybe turning a screened porch into a four-season room, what are some of the things they should be thinking about? Ken?
Oh, well, we do a lot of those things. We get a lot of call for decks to porches, porches to screen porches to, three-season rooms, mm-hmm. three-season rooms to full four-season rooms. When you're going from a deck to a porch, you're adding a roof and you're adding wall structure, and quite often the piers that support the deck are inadequate to support the porch. So often we'll have to start from the bottom up. And sometimes it makes sense to take the whole thing apart. Sometimes you can work with what you have. We did a really nice porch recently. We were able to take portions of the porch apart, redig the holes, and put bigger piers in. When you go from an open porch to a screen porch, you're working with an existing roof structure, and you're basically enclosing it. So it's more of a cosmetic thing. It's like, how does this porch fit with the style of the house? How do the railings look? How high is the deck off the deck of the porch off the grade? Will you need a railing system? And if so, you know, what we want to do is make sure that it fits with the style of mm-hmm. the house and is also safe.
So it doesn't look like it was just tacked on.
Yeah, I mean, the worst thing, you know, is having just something that, you know, putting a square peg in a round hole or something. You know, it's just, you just want to respect the style of the home.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to an enclosed porch to make it a three-season or four-season room, the things you want to really be concerned about are making sure that you've got that ventilation in the attic, is because you're closing it up, so you're making it part of the home. So you want to make sure that the roof is ventilated, and most porches are not. Open porches mm-hmm. are not, so you'll want to add ventilation. You'll also want to double check to make sure any headers are big enough in size to support, and headers are the support members that support the roof, like over windows and that sort of thing. So you want to look at those and make sure that there's adequate support there. You also want to make sure that you can insulate underneath the floor. If it's just going to be a three-season room, you never think you're going to turn it into a four-season room, you don't have to worry about insulation or closing it in. But if you think that sometime in the future you may, and you're going to be tearing parts of the porch apart, you may want to get those parts insulated now, even if you're not going to heat it at mm-hmm. this point.
Well, and actually, we had an email from Sean in Madison, who's considering turning a three-season porch into a master bedroom mm-hmm. and was wondering if the foundation would be better as a solid concrete slab, or would a crawl space be better?
That's a good question. Yeah, a crawl space or a full basement?
Or a solid concrete slab.
Well, if you could do a crawl space, then you could get under the room in the future, you have potential for storage. You have a place to run ducting and any sort of, if you're going to have a sink or something, you've got a place to run plumbing. It has to be below grade anyway. So even if you put a slab in, you're going to want to set that slab on a frost wall that goes down to grade. Why bother just putting the slab down on the ground unless you have a grading issue and that's the only place you could do it? I would say that if you can do a crawl space, vent it to the inside, access it from the inside of the basement, that's a really nice way to do it. You can insulate the perimeter, you can insulate under floor if you need to, but you've got a lot of flexibility.
And it gives you some options in the future.
Yeah, always think about the future. Mm-hmm. What might you do in the future and try to plan for it now.
Great. All right, let's go back to
Good luck, Sean.
Yeah, let's go back to the phone and Ellen in Sun Prairie. Hi, Ellen.
Hi.
Hi.
What's your question?
My question is, we're going to be getting a new roof on the house, and is going with metal roofing. I don't know really anything about it. My father just had it done to his home, but I noticed that they removed the roof vents. And he was told that the venting actually goes through the metal panels. I mean, is that correct?
No. In a word, no. Most metal roofs, if they're standing seam metal roofs, will have a vent up at the ridge. And these are usually fairly complicated vents, but they always are vented up at the ridge. You really do need, even with a metal roof, you don't have the thing where you have an asphalt shingle almost literally melting, but metal certainly moves, and so you do not want to end up with a 200-degree roof because it is going to push and pull against the fasteners. So a metal roof does still need to be correctly vented.
It's going to be going over shingles, so they put their... What is it? They're 1x2 slats, and then they put insulation board in between their 1x2 slats that they're putting on the roof to adhere the metal to.
That sounds like a very peculiar system.
Mm-hmm.
First, you're adding additional weight. If there are two layers of shingles on that roof already, you're going to have to remove those shingles. You need to decrease the weight on this roof as much as you possibly can. Is there no attic underneath this roof, Ellen?
There is, but it's not used. There's just a little, like a little 2-foot by 2-foot hole with a board covering it that goes up to the attic, so it's not finished by no means, and I don't even know if you could really stand up in it.
Are they thinking of moving the thermal barrier from the ceiling of the house up into the rafters?
Couldn't tell you.
Okay. It sounds, I think you need some professional advice here. What I'm hearing is worrying me a little bit, is that we're not going to have adequate ventilation and that you may end up with two thermal barriers, neither of which are very efficient, which is going to give you some issues for heating and cooling. You may want to, you're in Sun Prairie, there's lots of consultants in the area with whom you can speak, an architect or an engineer who's knowledgeable about these things. But I'm a little concerned that this sounds like, and maybe I'm just misunderstanding it too, Ellen. I don't want to badmouth somebody. Maybe I'm misunderstanding it, but I'm not comfortable with the description of it at this point.
And Ken?
I agree with John. Yeah, I think that you need to bring in a professional to make sure that you're on the right page, because we may not be understanding you clearly, or you may be... in for some problems if we are understanding you correctly.
Sounds like need for some follow-up there, Ellen, so glad you called. Let's go on to Dolores in Cedarburg next. Hi, Dolores.
Hello. Our house was built in 1976, and in 2008, I opted to update the exterior. And I had James Hardy cement board siding put on with Tyvek under it. Aluminum soffits with venting were put over the existing plywood soffits. I had a new roof with ridge vents put in and leaf guard gutters and the remaining casement windows. In the winter of 2008, I had terrible ice dams up to 5 foot-long icicles. There were contractors who came out here for other things and said they had never seen such ice dams.
Mm-hmm. It sounds to me...
I was unable to address the insulation in 2009, but in fall of 2010, I had an energy analysis done mm-hmm. and insulation put in.
Dolores, can I ask you a question, Dolores?
Sure.
Do you know if your contractor, when he put in the vented, the aluminum soffit, the underhang, did he make sure that it vented through the old plywood soffit continuously?
What they did when they put on the aluminum soffits was they put in periodic vented panels, but the fellow who insulated said just to make sure there's enough ventilation, he took those insulated panels off, cut some, maybe 2-inch holes in the plywood soffits and then put a different venting sheet over that.
Well, what it sounds like is that, first of all, you have inadequate soffit ventilation. It sounds like between the aluminum and the plywood, you're not getting enough air moving into the attic space. Secondly, it may appear that you don't have enough, we call them proper vents. What they are is they're a little either styrofoam or cardboard panel that holds the insulation away from the underside of the roof so that the insulation doesn't fill that gap and air can move up freely. And what we usually recommend is to have one in every space. Thirdly, if you have adequate ridge ventilation, but that's the first place I would start looking. And maybe your contractor could come back and, well, you know what, there's another reason to go to Corvette and start looking there or bring in a consultant on this one because...
I think you're right, Ken. Yeah. Jennifer, I believe, has put the Corvette site up on the Facebook page for Larry Mueller's show, Dolores. So you can go there and read a little bit on the Corvette literature, and you may be able to do some calculations yourself based upon your house size to know how much venting you really need.
It may help you get the right questions to ask a consultant. It sounds to me like you would be very well served to get a qualified inspector over there or some sort of an engineer that knows about ventilation and can help you walk through the system and get this problem resolved.
And for Dolores and others, just so you know, the show page is The Larry Mueller Show on Facebook. And you don't have to be a member of Facebook to actually go there and look at the resources there. And there is a link to Corvent, and it's CORA-VENT.com. But you can follow the link there. That brought up an interesting question. You know, often I think homeowners know that they're in over their heads. Hopefully they realize that they're in over their heads before it's too late and that they could really use, you know, some professional advice or consultation. When you talk about a qualified person to do that, how do you find, you know, are there networks, are there certifications that you should, what kind of questions should you ask of people?
First, call John. And he can help point you in the right direction.
There you go. Ken's whole theory is that they're happy to do follow-up, but he sends them all to John.
No, John, seriously, John knows a lot.
Okay, so John knows a lot.
Where you can start is you can start with a home inspector. Home inspectors have to be registered with the state of Wisconsin, and many of them are members of either the National Association of Home Inspectors, the American Society of Home Inspectors. Mm-hmm. And you can go to their websites and get home inspectors in your area that have professional membership as well as registration, which means they're spending a little more time, a little more money, a little more education. And then interview them. Ask them about their specialties. You will find some that really know a great deal about venting. There are some that they know enough to pass the exam. But start with a home inspector. The second place to go to is to energy auditors. That is going to cost more money. And if you're into a question of venting, an energy audit does not always pick up venting problems, because what they're really looking at is they're looking at heat loss. Mm-hmm. So you can have the heat loss fairly limited into your attic, but if you have absolutely no venting, even that minor heat loss may be causing ice damming on your house. So that would be the second place to go. After that, I would say the next stop is with a knowledgeable architect. Strangely enough, you're going to find many architects are less expensive on an hourly basis than a home inspector. And the way building is right now, you may want to call some local architecture firms. I know Cedarburg has got some absolutely wonderful architects. Mm-hmm. And Dolores may want to call a local firm there and see if they'll come over and spend 2 or 3 hours taking a look at her house. But try to go to people that have some sort of registration or licensing, but interview everybody before you hire.
Great. That's great advice, I think, for a lot of people, not just Dolores, but hopefully that's a help to her as well. Let's go on to Kurt in Tomahawk. Hi, Kurt.
How you doing?
Good.
Good. I got a question back to roofs. I've got some moss and mold growing on the north side of my home. Now, there is a few trees that are close to the house, but not too much. And I realize the sun doesn't hit it, but I notice more off the valleys off my dormers, I get this little bit of green moss growing in that black mold that seems to grow on the roof. And and I'm wondering what's the easiest way to get rid of that and prevent that from coming back.
Well, one way, I'm not sure you can really get rid of it real easily, Kurt, but what we are now specifying, if we're up in Tomahawk on the north side of the house, is we're specifying shingles that actually have zinc granules in them. Mm-hmm. And you can actually buy zinc strips, and you can stick them underneath your shingles, and the zinc will slowly wear off the strips, and that acts as a biocide. You may have noticed these really old farmhouses used to have these ornate zinc-plated ridges on them with all the little knobs and things. Well, those weren't just there to be pretty. That was to act as a biocide to keep the moss from growing on the wooden shingles. So you can do the same thing, and then the next time you re-roof, have your roofer specify a shingle that has a biocide zinc in it.
Great. I hope that helps, Kurt. And let's go to Bob in Green Bay next. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I've got an older house that I have to paint. It hadn't been painted for a while, and the places where the paint is flaked off, the wood is gray, and I'm getting mixed advice on whether or not I have to sand that to clear wood, or if it's a bad idea if lead paint, or if I can put a sealer or wood hardener on there. Do you have any suggestions?
I think you should go to the Forest Product Laboratory website here in Madison. You'll find several nice things on painting in their library. So click on the library, then it'll give you a list of topics. Go to painting and click on the one about painting over oxidized wood. That is going to give you a lot of information. There's at least 4 articles in there that are worth your downloading. It's all free service of the Forest Products Lab here in Madison.
You could also go to the EPA website and learn more information about how to treat wood that's painted with lead paint, because if your house is older than 1978, you can almost bet that there's going to be lead in the paint, and you don't want to just willy-nilly sand and chisel and let that those chips go everywhere. There are specific techniques that you can do that are safe and that will get the job done. So good luck to you.
Great, thanks, Bob. Let's go to Susie in Scandinavia. Hi, Susie.
Good morning, or afternoon, I guess it is.
Just barely.
Time flies, you know. Question about a 100-year-old plus farmhouse that we have just remodeled. No way to move or to install cold air returns to the upstairs where the bedrooms are. Mm-hmm. So in the winter, we have a cold air inversion of a sort where the heat doesn't rise up a rather large stairway. You can feel exactly where the warm air is being constricted. Will not rise upstairs. And in the summer, there is little air movement, obviously, even though the air conditioning does come out of the vents, it doesn't really cool off the upstairs. So I'm wondering if you have any suggestions as to what we could do to ameliorate this problem.
Susie, without actually seeing the house, it's hard to give advice, but I think when we remodel a lot of houses in the Madison area, I'm always telling people, get rid of your chimney. It gives you a 2-foot by 2-foot hole in your house. So we tell people to go to side-vented water heaters, side-vented furnaces, and many of these old houses have the old 2-foot by 2-foot brick chimney going up the middle. If you get rid of that, it's a great place for high returns to go up. Plus, there's a tremendous amount of air that goes up around those chimneys into the attic. Do you happen to have such a chimney in your house, Susie?
Well, I think our house predated that technology. No, they had a pot-bellied stove in the originally in the living room, and mm-hmm. then that has been consumed by the remodeling that was done upstairs.
So the chimneys are simply gone.
Okay. Gone.
Yeah, what you may have to do is it may end up with some plaster cutting, but somehow you're going to have to get a return system run to the second floor to get it to work efficiently. Now, of course, if this were a really old farmhouse that you hadn't remodeled, it would leak so badly that it wouldn't make any difference. But now that you've sealed it, you're going to have to rely upon mechanical ventilation. So talk to a local HVAC contractor up there. And Ken?
Yeah, we've had some good luck finding like the back of a closet would take the plaster off the back of a closet and run a duct work up in there for return air. Sometimes you can have good luck with putting a rather large return air vent at the bottom of the stairs and then supplement it with some extra heat runs up to the top. John's right. Get a good heating, good HVAC company that has the ability to design the system for your house, and they'll fix you right up.
Okay, thanks for that call, Susie. And John in Green Bay has a question. Hi, John.
Hello. I'll make it real quick. I'm going to be doing a lot of remodeling here, an old home, an old outbuilding barn. What is going to be more versatile in the way of buying a saw, whether it be a table saw compared to a radial arm? What's going to give me a little more, you know, versatility?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, when I was a kid, one of my first power tool purchases was a Craftsman radial arm saw. And I loved that thing, but it was completely out of square, and I would make four or five cuts, and then I'd have to spend an hour trying to square it up. So I would say, unless they've gotten better with it, if I was going to get a radial arm saw, I would get something a lot higher caliber, a lot higher quality. What a lot of us do in the field is we'll have a decent table saw, like the Makita 10-inch table saw. I don't know, it might be $700-$800, portable saw. That you so you can move it, stick it in the corner of your garage when you're not using it, and then get a decent miter box. And that miter box could have an extension table on it. You could go to a local lumber yard or maybe your local Ace Hardware. I'm sorry, you're up in Green Bay, so there's going to be plenty of outlets. And or go to a job site. Go to a place there's some contractors working on the job, and ask them what they're using. They'll point you in the right direction. Us guys love talking about the tools.
John, would you like to jump in on the tool talk?
I know that our local lumber yards here, the professional lumber yards, not like the Home Depots, but the ones that sell to the contractors, often have tool day.
Yeah.
And so they'll have the Makita guy in there, and they'll have things for 15, 20% off. So call your local lumber yards. Ask them if they've got a tool day coming up.
And they'll stand behind the product, so you've got somebody to go to if you have an issue.
That is correct, John. You'll walk in there looking like you're a professional or something, put a name tag on, and they will treat you royally because they want your business.
Does wearing a tool belt help?
No. But if you do get wear a tool belt, make sure it's a leather one.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding. It doesn't matter.
Well, thanks for that call. We have just about a minute left. Greg in Iron River called with a tip. In his experience, it's common for soffit vents to get plugged or severely restricted by various tree or dandelion fuzz and spider webs. He finds it's a good idea to blow them clean with compressed air each fall to ensure you get adequate ventilation in the winter.
I think that's a wonderful idea. And, you know, the problem is we don't normally do that as humans. We don't really prepare our house. There's another thing that I like to tell people, that plumbers recommend that you replace the seal at your toilet every 2 to 3 years. When was the last time that you pulled your toilet and put a new wax mm-hmm. seal there?
Probably the last time it started
last
leaking.
Time it leaked. But that's a great idea.
Great. Well, it's been a great chat with Ken Adams of Adams Design Construction and John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates. Thanks so much for coming in today, both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Tomorrow at 11, it's another edition of Garden Talk, and we'll be joined by Neil DeBull of Prairie Nursery in Westfield. He'll tell us especially how to keep weeds under control in your prairie. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network.